Mr. Justice Black, enjoined in asserting before him only a minor role to play in protecting interstate commerce. In your 1955 Indian lectures, however, you take a broader view of the court's function in this field. Does this 1955 statement more closely reflect your current thinking?
My thinking underwent on that subject a rather radical revision since I was on the court. When I first came on the court, I was inclined to lump together all decisions that struck down state laws that dealt with social and economic matters, whether by reason of conflict with the Commerce Clause, conflict with the federal law, or conflict with what the judges might think was due process of law as used in the 14th Amendment. But as the stream of cases continued, a reorientation in my mind took place. It's a rather common experience for judges to change as a result of exposure to new or different problems, or to increase the dosages of old problems. I think that that Black has more or less stuck with his earlier view expressed in those cases that you mentioned. I've got pretty much away from them, and I concluded some time back that Commerce Clause, both in its affirmative and its negative aspects, was probably a very useful, important, outstanding document in developing areas of free trade in America, that it gave us what's now known as the common market without state tariffs and barriers, and that the work of the court over the years in policing that domain had been very important. So I moved to the opposite side of the circle in my thinking, and that's where I ultimately arrived, and I think that's probably my resting point. As I say, I don't think Black has changed, at least changed so much as I have, but that is the one element in the constitutional law that has brought about greatest change in me since I've been on the court.
Somewhat different matter. Justice Burns served for such a short time on the court that it is impossible for students to arrive at an accurate estimate of his work. What was your impression of him as a colleague? Do you think if he'd stayed on the bench, he might have developed into a great judge?
Jimmy Burns was an old friend. I knew him when I was in the executive branch and he was in the Senate. He was very unhappy when he was on the court. He was very, very happy when he was in the halls of Congress. He was named by Roosevelt I think in June 1941, shortly before Roosevelt named Stone as Chief Justice and Jackson. The three of them came on about the same time. Jimmy Burns is a man that was at his best in a cloakroom where he was getting somebody by the lapel and with a smile or a joke softening him up or getting him to qualify his position, and so on. He was a mediator in the political sense, and walked a very tight rope, very, very skillfully. When he got to the court, he was sitting there in his office with all these problems in front of him and the books staring at him from the bookshelves. But there was nobody coming in to talk with him. He was very restless, very, very unhappy. He didn't like the isolation of the court, and I don't think he ever would have enjoyed it, because he was had been for too many years outside the realm of scholarship, outside the realm of even legislative drafting. Jimmy Burns was a man up for the hustings, and I don't think that he would have settled down at any, no matter how long he'd stayed here. And I think he was very happy when Roosevelt gave him a chance to get off the bench and head up one of the war agencies.
I was wondering whether there was anything in your relationship that might have led you to believe that after the school segregation cases, he would become such a bitter critic of the court.
I think that if Jimmy Burns had been on the court when Brown versus Board of Education had been decided, he would have been a very loud dissenter. Jimmy Burns, at the time he was on the court, at the time he was in Washington, D.C., felt very, very sensitive about the Negro problem. And we had a lot of Negro cases during that time, and he would always approach them very gingerly. He was, Jimmy Burns was not a libertarian. I imagine that if he stayed on the court, he, inside the court, would have been as bitter a critic of the court as he has been on the outside. On the question of the Negro, on the question of the racial problem, not on the other issues. I think he probably would have settled down to some kind of reconciliation of his views with those of the majority in other areas, but the racial thing was too deep-seated. I don't think that would have ever been removed from his mind as a judge.
Burns resigned, Roosevelt consulted Chief Justice Stone about a successor. Stone strongly recommended Learned Hand, and apparently several other people. Well, the Stone papers are not quite clear on who these were, except that Stone twice denied having recommended Rutledge. Do you know anything in the background of Rutledge's selection? Whether any associate justices were consulted, whether any of them were actively interested in having him on or off the court?
Well, I know something about the Rutledge appointment. The first time that I met Wiley Rutledge was when I walked into the ante room of the subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee to consider my nomination to this court, because at the time that Roosevelt set my name up for this court, he sent Wiley Rutledge's name up for the Court of Appeals here in the District of Columbia. Wiley Rutledge at that time, at the time he was appointed to the Court of Appeals, was in Iowa. He was dean of the law school. Prior to that time, he had been in St. Louis. In St. Louis, while he was at the university, Washington University, he made many friends, and there was no warmer friend that he had than Irving Brandt, who later was to become the great biographer of James Madison. And Irving Brandt had great admiration for Rutledge. There were people in the Iowa delegation who were also very admirers of Riley Rutledge. Congressman Ike Iker was one. But I think it was Irving Brandt that got Roosevelt to name Rutledge to the Court of Appeals. Irving Brandt had a close relationship to Roosevelt. He didn't see him very often. Roosevelt had great confidence in him, and he would slip in for 5 minutes, and in those 5 minutes get things done that others were unsuccessful in getting done. And so when the Burns vacancy occurred on the court, there was a great promotion going on for Learned Hand. At that time, I'd see Roosevelt with a small group, either at Henry Morgenthau's house or at the house of Harold Ickes out in Olney, Maryland. Usually one of those two places to play poker. And we'd have dinner and then play poker. One of the rules was that nobody could discuss anything serious at those poker evening sessions. This was for Roosevelt's relaxation. And so nobody brought up anything serious. It was always a gay, lighthearted evening. And one night in February 1943, we were foregathered at Morgenthau's house having dinner preparatory to poker, and I was sitting on Roosevelt's left at the table, and he turned to me and he said, would you like to know who's not going to be appointed to take Jimmy Burns' place on the Supreme Court? And I said, with a smile, I'm bursting with curiosity, but according to the rules of these poker sessions, I never would be invited back if I asked you, because we're not supposed to talk business. Well, he said, there's no reason why I can't bring it up. Would you like to know who is, or can you guess who's not going to be appointed? And I said, no, I have no idea who is being considered. Well, he said, the man who's not going to be appointed is Learned Hand. And I said, well, Mr. President, you're going by a very distinguished person. I've often thought he would be a great addition to the bench. He put down his fork and he turned to me. His jaw was set. His Dutch was up, so to speak. Roosevelt could get very stubborn at times. He said, well, this time your brother Frankfurter has overplayed his hand. And I said, in what respect? He said, 19 people have seen me or called me today saying I must appoint Learned Hand. And he said, by God, I'm not going to do it. As near as I could tell, he was not using 19 people as a figure of speech. There actually had been 19 people. And call him. The campaign that Frankfurter put on was so intense that Roosevelt reacted the other way. It so happened that at about 6:05 that night, Margaret Lahan, Roosevelt's secretary, came in and said, would you have just 5 minutes to see Irving Brandt? And he said, sure, send him in. And Irving Brandt said, Mr. President, I got the man for you to filled that vacancy for Jimmy Burns and Roosevelt, who just made up his mind, he was mad, just made up his mind that he would not appoint Learned Hand, said, "You're just the man I'm looking for. Whom shall I appoint?" And Irving Brand said, "Wiley Rutledge." And Roosevelt said, "That's my man." And in a few days, he sent up Wiley Rutledge's name, and that's the way in which the Rutledge appointment was made to this court. I never told Learned Hand this story, and I'm sorry that I didn't, because I think he would have been very much interested, of course, and in retrospect would probably have enjoyed the story very much, because he knew Frankfurter. They were very close in a way, and yet he knew that the weaknesses of Frankfurter. He knew that Frankfurter was a great divisive influence in any group that he joined, and often talked to me about it, that no group would be a happy group that Frankfurter joined, because his tactics would be to try to split the group, to get one against the other, and somehow or other to himself come out ahead. And how he had utilized all these prominent men, I don't know who all the 19 were who Paul Roosevelt saw him that day, was a part of the Frankfurter strategy, because I don't suppose any time since he's been on the court did he ever spend more than about 4 hours a day doing court work. Most of his time was spent in getting things done in government, getting judges appointed or people not appointed in various departments, getting lawyers or whatnot salted away in government. It was sort of a passion with him, and the way in which he promoted Learned Hand was Frankfurter at his best, which turned out to be Frankfurter at his worst, because we missed out on getting a good man for the court. Rutledge was, in retrospect, probably a much better choice than Hand, because Rutledge brought a very fresh mind to the task, and Hand was a person who was pretty largely by that time committed, I think, to the conception of the Constitution that was quite at war with the one that that Rutledge brought to the court.
Well, to a entirely different topic, one that's more personal. Several students of the court pointed out that at least in your first 7 years on the bench, your voting record shows a peculiarity regarding deference to administrative agencies. And that is, you consistently voted to sustain decisions of all the independent agencies except the Interstate Commerce Commission. Would you say that this is only another example of the inability of statistical analysis to take account of important differences between cases? Or would you say that the reason lies in your own approach to administrative law?
I have never seen those figures, and I don't know whether I assume that they're accurate. I don't know what a 20-year summary would show. I came to the court out of an administrative agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission. I'd seen the administrative process at the bureaucratic level, and had fought the battle in Congress and in the courts for maintenance of administrative law. At the SEC, we were in some very bitter controversies At one time, I think we had as many as 200 cases in courts where courts were trying to enjoin us. I mean, where parties were trying to get courts to enjoin us from doing one thing or another. And I suppose that, therefore, I came to the bench with a prejudice in favor of the administrative agency, that a person who did not have that experience might lack. I don't know that it was what you'd call a prejudice born of intellectual experience so much as practical workings of an agency. I never taught, had never taught administrative law, having been identified with a very active agency that was in lots of trouble, lots of litigation, I probably carried over to the bench a feeling for agency prestige that that some of my brethren may not have had. I'm not aware of any particular experience that I'd had with the ICC that should have led to a different result. My first impression, though, of ICC work was not a very good one from the point of view of the ICC. I felt that they were, in quality, a very inferior agency from the basis of the kind of things that they turned out. The opinions that sometimes were hardly intelligible, rambling, disjointed opinions. You could hardly tell where the findings were. I had very little relationship to the Interstate Commerce Commission. I'd had some at the administrative level. I felt that they probably had reached the point that all agencies eventually reach, namely that they are very much oriented to the group that they are regulating. I think that is a natural development that the group in charge of regulating a particular industry ends up eventually with the industry's point of view, and not in any venal sense, but becomes sort of a spokesman for that one point of view, which in the case of the Interstate Commerce Commission or the railroad interests, they had large competitors in the buses and the trucks that were filling the highways and in the barges that were trying to carry wheat and other commodities up and down the rivers and across lakes. And the orientation, I think, of the Interstate Commerce Commission was, as a result of their close affiliation, was to the railroads and against these other groups. An awareness of that, or a feeling that that was the truth of the matter, that set me off on a different course as respects the ICC. But by and large, I think that I was rather agency-minded. Agency-minded in a way that perhaps a person who had not been on an agency but had just practiced before an agency might not be. Perhaps I was too agency-minded. But everyone comes to a particular job with a particular background and an experience he has had in previous works for these lines of activity usually is reflected in what he does. That's why I have always thought that the clearance of members of this court through the Senate was an extremely desirable thing. Because a person's background, the things that he has been doing, whether he's been a special pleader for a union or for a railroad or for bankers or for farmers, does play a part in the totality of his philosophy, his attitude, his reactions. He has developed certain calluses. He has some blinders to other points of view. And the screening at the Senate level, I think, is an extremely important part of the selection of judges. I think that the Senate has sometimes made mistakes. I think that Parker, whom they turned down, probably would have been a greater judge of this court than Owen Roberts turned out to be. Much as I like Roberts, I think that Parker, who was opposed by organized labor because he had followed the Yellow Dog contract case of decided by our court, was one of the men that had great capacity for growth, and I think he probably would have developed greatly here. So I think that the rejection of Parker by the Senate was a great tragedy. But nevertheless, the process is an important one. All power can be abused, but the airing of qualifications of judges is for this court, for other federal courts, is a very important stage in the selecting process.
A little while ago, we were talking about the Roberts letter. And now that you've had a chance to look at your files, would you like to say anything more?
The matter of that letter to Justice Roberts, who had resigned from the court, came up during the summer recess, and I was out in Oregon, and it was taken up by Stone, who was Chief Justice, after Roberts resigned. I don't recall any conference discussion about it. It first arose during that summer when Stone prepared a draft of a letter and sent it to Black, asking Black if he would sign it and pass it on. Mason's book on Stone contains the draft of the farewell letter that Stone prepared, and when Black received the letter, he suggested in a correspondence with Stone, as Mason points out, some revision. The account that Mason gives is not a complete account. It doesn't reflect the very deep bitterness that Roberts had towards Black, towards me, towards Murphy, and towards Rutledge. This was a bitterness also partly directed to Stone, although not principally directed to him. It was a bitterness that was inspired by Frankfurter, who had convinced Roberts that one of us, probably either myself or Murphy, was leaking court news to the press. a fact which never took place. So when, as a result of that rumor that Frankfurter spread that necessitated the conference, which I was too sick to attend on account of a flu, as a result of Frankfurter's denunciation of me or Murphy as the culprits, and Robert's belief in that, as a result of Robert's visit with Black, in which Black said that he stood by Murphy and me